Between us and our computing devices is the user interface, or UI. The ways we communicate with our machines, and the ways our machines communicate with us, is essential to the quality of our overall user experience. This has never been more true than with artificial intelligence. The enhanced power of AI-infused software relies on not just the correct data getting from us to the machine, but then on the machine's sophistication interpreting it. To explore where UI and AI are going, we are joined by Erica Lee, Executive Director and Founder of womenofai.org. Erica's eclectic background includes time as an AI startup founder, research scientist, and tech lead. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in the world of AI automation. Let's get started. Machines don't work unless we've communicated with them, whether that is user interface, with the person manipulating the explicit controls of a machine, or implicit in the very form of a machine made in a specific way to actually just do. With our earliest machines, this was all pretty simple. Think of an abacus, requiring the operator to have merely knowledge of simple mathematics and the ability to use a finger or similar device to move the beads to and fro. The earliest interfaces with our machines and technology was concrete, physical, and direct. As machines became more complicated, this changed. It took the printing press to get to the typewriter, and it took the typewriter to get to the computer keyboard. Punched cards are anachronistic today, but it was mere decades ago that this technology, which possibly originated in 1725 with Basile Bouchon in the control of a loom, evolved to accelerate early mechanical computing, joining the keyboard as the two most important devices for computer user interfaces, to say nothing of the punch card's greater role in data storage and retrieval. It was only in the 1980s that the mouse became a core user interface device with the rise of Apple computers and graphical user interfaces, and just over a decade ago that the gestural conventions of mobile computing helped turn computing from a workplace or nerdy sometimes activity into the always-on ubiquity we experience today here in the United States. It's important to remember how recent all of this is. Punched cards have a much richer history than the mouse in the historical computing ecosystem, even if it was the usability offered by the mouse that helped computing become mainstream. The moment we're in is fleeting, and we could be years, not decades away from the mouse as we know it shifting into a peripheral role. Computing, the internet, mobile technology, and more recently, artificial intelligence churn through the present like a shark through chum. What seemed forever yesterday will already be obsolete tomorrow, without our even realizing it. Where artificial intelligence is concerned, our guest this week, Erica Lee, is all in, so to speak. Despite her young age, she has built her own AI startup, worked at Apple, been part of the learning communities at places like MIT, Oxford, Google, and Singularity University. And her life mission is even related to what she wants to achieve in AI. We are excited to welcome her onto Creative Next to share her knowledge with us. Much of the recent rise of AI is built on the availability and processing of big data. As important as that is, the most interesting AI applications will be the one that intertwine with our day-to-day lives. To best do that, machines need to understand what we want or don't. That comes back to user interface and how we input commands to the machine. With this in mind, Erica talks to us about how UI today is changing, particularly the recent trend to voice UI and how it works in consumer applications.
I feel like I've had such an amazing privilege to grow through two decades of different UI technology, all the way from desktop to mobile to now voice interfacing. The way I see voice right now is a lot of people use it as a system to do direct commands with setting alarms or playback music with start, stop, next. It's really simple commands to a computer. Instead of pushing a button, you're just using your voice. So right now, like, my entire house is automated with both Amazon Alexa and Google Home Assistant to help change music, set timers, read calendars, do a lot of, I call it low-level functions. It's been really helpful just saving me time. And voice interface is now actually starting to merge with visual interfaces. There's this new trend, at least in home electronics, with screens being attached to a lot of these sound systems. Amazon recently released in the past year the Echo Show, which has a screen with a front-facing camera. You not just can say, you know, play the next song, we can actually see the album cover and the name of it, and sometimes even like graphics or animations behind it. So it's becoming more interactive and immersive. And also the technology behind the input, which for most people is usually like the microphone. So the way a device captures information is significantly improving. So Apple is very good at this. They have their device called the HomePod, which when you say, hey Siri, you know, play the next song, it'll know the difference between my voice and then let's say a friend or another woman in the room.
The integration of voice with visuals is an important step. We've never come anywhere close to the immersive computing environment in the movie Minority Report, for example, now some 17 years ago. At the time, that was touted as the future, a fictional portrayal based on the input of futurists and technologists who understood how things would evolve soonish. We still aren't there yet. In fact, our reality doesn't even feel close. Still, the integration of improving voice interface with our display environments is one step on that path. I suspect many of you have already tinkered with technologies like these, if not with a hardware device like Alexa, then at least using software on your phone, like Siri. If not, I urge you to. Buy an Alexa. Lean into the voice UI on your phone. The present isn't great. My Alexa is currently unplugged out of my frustration with it. But this is the path to the future. If you want to make the most of it, understand where things are and where they are going, you need to participate in it. Now, let's hear how Erica thinks UI will evolve into more passive and automated inputs.
My personal perspective, and I hope the industry moves in this way, is the system is less one way where I tell the machine to do something, but it's more of a feedback loop where occasionally I will put in requests to my Siri to like change my calendar or to check my mail. But really the system has many different sensors and many different inputs to read my behavior. So the preference would be is I wake up and, you know, right now I have my Amazon Show next to my bed and my Google Home Assistant with the screen. So they have cameras, like they're all staring at me and hearing me 24/7. It can read my heart rate based on my device. It can see the gesture of my face. It can look at my sleeping patterns over time and tell me, hey, like based on your calendar, we realize you don't have a meeting this morning. You know, we can snooze the alarm for 2 hours and rebook a call so we can change your day to match your goals of improving your cholesterol levels by lowering it down and increasing your overall exercise by allowing you to, you know, spend your afternoon walking and moving your whole day back and getting up and sleep.
That is certainly a model of machines at their very best, passively leveraging all of the data available on the network and then automating environments and experiences in ways that are optimal for each unique person. It's also safely within the bounds of existing technology we are already familiar with. It's just smarter. Another emerging interface paradigm is gestural.
So we are moving towards that where it is more gesture related. If you think about it, like Apple has integrated Face ID, which is a purely like visual way of unlocking devices. So it's a secure authentication way. Just using your face. We have new gesture oriented technology. Most people don't really talk about Xbox Kinect, but it was one of the first, you know, consumer facing technologies to really read on body gestures. They could see your skeletal system. They could see all the different joint movements on an XYZ axis. They could actually even do signature and heat mapping, as well as be able to like read emotions on your face. So I think AI technology is going to be more adaptive to human behavior because we're collecting significant amount of data on people's bodies and the way they think and the type of decisions they make on apps.
Gestural, like voice, is a good step toward more humane computing environments, compared with the touchscreen, mice, and monitors we've become accustomed. But perhaps the ultimate interface is one that is direct from our brain to the machine. If the machine were able, either pulling from our brain or by pushing our thoughts at it, taking out thoughts as input data in order for it to act, well, that would certainly be remarkable. I remember first reading about patents for this brain-computer interface some 15 years ago. Obviously, though, there are no commercialized solutions on the market yet. Let's hear Erica talk about the potential of these technologies.
Regarding BCI, for those who don't know what the term is, it stands for brain-computer interface. So this is essentially any device that helps bridge the data connection between a human brain and then a computational device like a computer. So my experience was I was first introduced through a hackathon called Neurotech based in San Francisco. And I worked with a team of developers to build a device that essentially helped track seizures. So a lot of seizures is basically an abnormal activity of brain waves in the brain. So it doesn't, that's not necessarily being accurate, but understanding when there's a deviance in the actual brain pattern wave, what we were tracking. So using a headset, they called it an HMD or head mount display. We used an off-the-shelf one through Emotive, which is a manufacturer, and they had a specific sensor on the headset that captured a form technology or data called EEG. EEG is essentially a type of a measurement for measuring brain activity. So we built basically just simple algorithms that would see when there was a spike in deviance. So if there's something was more than, I believe, 1.5 standard deviations from the average normal, from the actual norm or the baseline, we built a text message system that would essentially text a caregiver when somebody might potentially be having a seizure. That way we could help notify, you know, parents if their kid was having a seizure that would not be normally marked with physical convulsions. And sometimes see in movies that like mainly seizures are when people's bodies are convulsively shaking and they're out of control. But there's a lot of classified seizures where it's almost like a locked-in syndrome where you're having a mental seizure, but your body isn't showing any physical symptoms. So we built this headset and this text message system. So I mean, the main use case was so a parent could be very self-aware of when their kid was going through a seizure and when to be there for them or to let them know that they're okay or if they wanted to consult a doctor or escalate it. So it wasn't designed to be like a medical diagnostic tool, but really a tool to expand human awareness about human body behavior. And I really loved it because I believe as we improve our sensor input and our understanding of human intelligence, how the brain works, how the body works, and how they work in relationship to each other, we can use that data and that information to really build products that help us with our goals in fitness, health, education, environment, and more.
The technology is still not ready for general use, as the requirement of wearing an intrusive headset runs counter to an unencumbered user experience. But these current applications take the idea of brain-to-computer interfaces out of the realm of unimaginable science fiction and move them into the universe of our future possibility. Pivoting from UI to AI, let's hear about some of the key challenges and opportunities Erica is seeing.
AI has been a technology that's been around for a while, but it's especially meaningful right now since people are realizing that they can turn data into insights. The thing I like to challenge people on is, you know, what problems are you trying to solve with those insights and how are you leveraging AI properly to solve them? Easy to build models, but are you building the models to optimize for the right outcomes? Since you can build something to optimize, let's say, for a specific type of drug therapy to solve a cancer disease, but what if the problem for curing cancer isn't necessarily going through that route? Maybe it's analyzing why cells from the beginning start mutating into cancer cells through cell phenotyping or different types of imbalances in antioxidants or something instead of cells or oxidation. I would like to challenge people in AI is, are you really using AI to solve what I call the root cause analysis, the RCA? And if you are, you know, what type of data and what type of tools you need to be able to get your outcome?
This strategic approach is important. We often hyper-focus on the technology itself as opposed to the proper systemic deployment of it. Erica's emphasis on strategy and root cause analysis is right on. It doesn't matter how awesome the technology is if it's deployed against the wrong problem.
With AI, the thing I'm most excited about is being able to augment decision-making, not necessarily automate it, is with algorithms, we can have more suggestions. You know, you see it through ads where when you're buying something online, let's say I'm trying to buy some running shoes that fit my feet, my color type, and my purchasing preferences in terms of cost and location. You know, algorithms are great because they know all the types of shoes that are online, and they actually have companies that pay to place their ads in front of you. With AI, it can show you different types of preferences and suggestions based on my parameters. So I can set the parameters, my needs, but AI just shows me a variety of suggestions that I would normally have to scrape the internet for. So it saves me a lot of time. And now we're starting to see it with some more smart technology, with like my Google Home, for instance, will suggest when it should set alarms for me, or when it should play or stop music, or when I go to bed, I set up a routine on my Alexa, which is when I say Prince, you know, good night, and Alexa will start reading off my calendar for the next day, turn my phone on do not disturb mode, start turning down the lights, start playing like classical piano music. It starts creating this like workflow automatically to really automate some of the decision making that I was going to do.
The distinction between automation and augmentation. Much of the excitement and fear about AI rests in the idea that it will automate lots of things. We even use the word automation in how we position Creative Next. Certainly, automation is part of the story. However, AI will have the greatest impact into the foreseeable future in augmentation. Rather than replace us, it will assist us. Sure, this augmentation will often be in the form of the automation of more simple and mundane things. But to understand the potential of AI in our lives, we need to remember that, at a macro level, it is augmenting us. In her writing, Erica refers to herself as, quote, building prototypes to production-ready AI, unquote. How does this differ from building normal software that is not utilizing AI?
So your inputs are the different types of data that you're looking at, and your output is what you're trying to predict. You're doing some sort of prediction or classification. So if your algorithms are not very accurate every time you run them, or you change the different data set or inputs that you're using, your accuracy might vary. Like your training loss might vary each time. And if you're, you know, if you're going to deploy something to 1 billion or 2 billion devices and you have really stringent high QA and security standards, having a margin of error typically is very low, like they, or not at all. Like you want a 99.99999999 reading accuracy. So if AI isn't what I like to call reliable, you know, it's good at one thing, but it's not very reliable at scale because it doesn't have the infrastructure to support it. It's actually a big risk to the consumer experience. Because if you roll out a feature that isn't very reliable, like a lot of the Siri features from the beginning, sometimes the voice detection wouldn't work very well. You'd say, hey Siri, like, you know, what time is it? And be like, I don't know what you're talking about, or I can't hear you, or hey, like Siri, call my mom. And be like, hey, do you want to call Mo? Do you want to call like Mo's Cafe? And you're like, no. And then you kind of just like go back and forth. You know, when something's not very reliable, people typically, you know, a painful experience will leave a more memorable impression than a positive experience. So people will stop wanting to use a product if they have one bad experience. Like you go to a restaurant, you get one time, you get food poisoning, you'll never return, but you might have gone there and had like 100 positive meals, and you don't remember them because they're too fleeting. So with AI, like if it's not reliable consistently over and over when it comes to production, you have a huge risk on the consumer experience. So I think companies are realizing it's better to not release an AI-driven feature until it's absolutely ready versus release it and damage their brand.
Product and marketing meet at the brand. AI has an unusually high potential to create bad experiences that damage a product's or even a company's brand. This is because being perceived as more advanced than the competition is an important competitive advantage. Additionally, offering advanced solutions also brings with it a sense of novelty, creating an extra wave of enthusiasm and virality from consumers who are delighted by a new or unusual experience. As a result, there is an incentive to rush exciting new solutions out so that your company can be the one that gets the halo of being advanced, along with the benefits of novelty effects. Unfortunately, particularly in the current generation of AI, failure is particularly likely. Remember earlier when I mentioned my Alexa is unplugged and not being used? It's actually more than that. I hate my Alexa. Before I quickly retired it, there were many moments of frustration, irritation, and even anger. I'm more likely to try a future Google or Apple solution than another from Amazon because of it. What does Erica consider the biggest market opportunities for AI-related initiatives?
On the consumer side, the biggest market is with home automation, with building devices at home to help you with like small tasks. I think we don't really know where it'll be going, but with the iPhone, we didn't know there was going to be a huge explosion of app store and like a marketplace for third-party app developers. I think we are going to eventually see an explosion of a marketplace to build consumer apps for the home at the intersection of home devices, mobile, and more. So, and like with wearables, I think there's definitely a market happening somewhere. Just no one's really figured out the value yet.
We will be talking with some companies working in these spaces later in the season. Now, Erica gives us an example of how one of the large tech companies is leveraging AI for home use.
So you see companies like Samsung. There's a lot of products at the home that have, like, it's called Wi-Fi capability. They have smart ovens, smart microwaves. My NutriBullet is called a smart NutriBullet. And essentially, if it can analyze the, at least the marketing, it can analyze the contents of your smoothie and give you an accurate calorie count up to, I think, plus or minus 20 calories, and then log it into an app. So if you're trying to manage your weight or hit your target calorie count, it's a way of automating the calorie count. So traditionally, a way is you manually do it on paper, or you go through their catalog and you're like, okay, blueberries is 20 calories. Like, have a banana is 30, and you kind of tally it up, like a checklist. They have sensors built in where it can figure it out. It's called IoT devices at home that have Wi-Fi connectivity and are clearly collecting data, but there is a huge silo between where that data is stored and where it actually gets integrated into an application that delivers value. So I've seen this market evolve over the past 5 years, and it'll probably be another 5 more years till we see a blossom.
This gets back into the smartware we talked about in season one. As much as AI is the hot and sexy tech of today, its development is reliant on the integration of other smartware technologies as well. Erica just mentioned the IoT, or Internet of Things. She was actually exposed to a full educational program around smartware during her time at Singularity University. Let's pivot to learn about that incredible learning center and its smartware curriculum. Also note that Erica refers to Singularity University as SU.
So SU is an amazing globally facing community that's, one, extremely diverse. So we had 80 students in my class from 40 different countries, and it was 50% men, 50% women. A hugely diverse community that was all focused on educating the individual about two domains. One was global markets, whether it was disaster resilience, poverty, renewable energy, transportation, healthcare, medicine. They had domain experts all across the world in these, and they'd bring them in as speakers to educate you on their expertise. So they focus on six domains: artificial intelligence / machine learning and data science, additive manufacturing, which is where you build things by adding on layers versus building something and subtracting. So traditional manufacturing is you build a mold and you fill it and then you cut away all the rest. Additive is much more better on overall cost and consumption of material, since you only build the things that you need. You don't have to take away and throw out. You can print something and use gravity to pull down it, so you can build like a little pillar by fitting it resin together, if you search at 3D printing. They also taught robotics called new interfaces, which is AR, VR, and MR, so mixed reality. So different ways to visualize, interact with surfaces, whether they're physical, projected, or not. And then they also taught something called digital biology track, which was ways that people were using technology to manipulate biology. And the most popular, well-known, is CRISPR-Cas9. It's essentially I can use technology to do something called gene editing. So the terminology is knock in, knock out, repair, edit. Basically, you can knock out a gene and knock in a new one, and you can repair the system of DNA or an RNA, and you can essentially edit the overall expression of what that gene is going to do. So this is good for certain chronic illnesses, because if it's, you can inherit a gene that's actually not positive towards your quality of life, you could theoretically use this technology to literally like erase it from your DNA, and your DNA is just essentially how your cells replicate. So over time, you can actually take out, it's almost like pruning a plant. You can prune out the branches that are diseased and you can keep the ones that are healthy.
We don't all need to go to Singularity University to keep up with the future. But the more your own personal learning includes getting smart on the sort of curriculum they focus on, the better positioned you will be in the years and decades ahead. Building on season one of Creative Next, which was about learning, let's hear how Erica learns and how she thinks education is going to be important for people who want to remain professionally relevant in the future.
As long as you're skilled in the ability to learn, you'll be adaptive to any market and any business and any job. And I think that's the biggest skill that many organizations don't teach you. There's always a new machine learning framework, and there's always a new paper, and there's always a new coding language, and there's always some new processor coming. There's always something new But if you can distinguish the difference between new, completely innovative, and then being able to master the skill to actually apply that, you will just naturally be left behind because the world's moving forward without you. I have a very personalized habit building system that has allowed me to master multiple different skill sets over the course of 2 decades, which is, I know the way I learn is like audio and visually, but I always consume knowledge in the way that's the path of least resistance to me. And then I live geographically in an area where people of that domain expertise are. You just naturally will hang out with them, become friends, join communities, go to meetups or events, sort of like interact in that environment. And then setting time every day to do it. So even if it's 10 minutes a day, it's like with fitness, my rule is I have 45 minutes and I have to get it done sometime today. I can move around that block of 45 minutes because there's a higher priority, but it has to get done that day. So I have blocks in my schedule and I move them around. I just can't delete them. So as long as you set a consistent amount of time every day or on a recurring basis to learn a skill, reading Mandarin text 5 minutes a day for 50 days, eventually you're going to learn something.
There's something very Silicon Valley in Erica's dedication to learning growth, at least for me, in the best possible way. Finally, we conclude with Erica's inspiring life mission.
My life mission, I like to say in the most funny, friendly manner, is building AaaS. So AaaS is AI as a service, literally AAAS. It's synonymous with SaaS, which is software as a service. But for me, AI really is a service. It's not a product, or it's not an algorithm or a model. It's when it's built properly, it's really a service of helping augment human decision-making. So when I can get it to be commercially viable enough as a quote-unquote service where you can actually pay to mobilize other people's intelligence on a global network to help solve your local and relevant problems, I will feel that I've completed something that is really, really valuable economically, socially, environmentally, physically, intellectually for the world. I don't think we're there yet. A, it's still clunky, and it's like this teenager trying to figure out what it's doing in the world, and it's got like little pimples, and it's sort of like still growing up, and it's so much fun to be sort of inside of it, the way like the internet was developed way before I was born. For me, like, I like to say I want to develop AI, but also at scale. So if I can impact more than 1 or 2 billion people, then I'll really feel that I've touched so many lives, depth and breadth. And that's, for me, I've always been in love with impact over anything else. So, you know, hopefully in my lifetime, I can invent like a powerful enough technology to really improve the human and environmental quality of people's lives. And if I can do that, especially anonymously, like I realize, like people don't need to know who my name is for me to feel like I've helped their life. As long as what I build can get distributed and given out quickly to people, then that's what I care about.
Thanks again to our guest, Erica Lee. So John, how did our interview with Erica impact your thinking about the work we're doing with Creative Next?
Yeah, what intrigued me about Erica's discussion of some of the technologies in and around voice user interface was particularly about how voice is still at a nascent stage, and that as sort of natural language processing and establishing context gets more sophisticated, we're going to have a much better set of interactions via our voice interfaces. So right now we have sort of limited sensors in and around ourselves to give the computer context as to what we're talking about. But at the same time, we're using natural language, which presupposes a certain context for that, you know, sometimes we can't convey to the computer and it gets very frustrating, hence you unplugging your Alexa, yes, yeah. Right? Because you're frustrated because you want the computer to understand the context. And not only that, it's not even sort of picking up on the most basic of commands. So that continuum moving from complete lack of context into a more contextualized interface, that really struck me as interesting because I think it's in line with a lot of the thinking we're doing with Creative Next is identifying the direction of the technologies and how they'll you know, enhance our abilities as human beings. So I thought that was an interesting comment about how the interface is evolving and how, you know, the frustrations of today are probably because we're early adopters, not because the technology will sort of never amount to, you know, what it's promised to be.
Yeah, you know, the thing that Erica said that most impacted my thinking about what we're doing is really, she brought me back to the importance of smartware. You know, John, you and I have been talking and writing about that for some years now, but it's uncommon to hear others also sort of identify the family of technologies that really together are writing the future. The fact Singularity University's curriculum mirrors almost exactly the different technologies we see as making up smartware, it reminds me to keep coming back to that broader story. It's easy to get up caught in UI, or it's easy to get caught up in AI these days. To really understand the future requires that bigger picture of smartware.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, and just to be a little bit more specific when we're talking about smartware, since we are starting out on a new season, so that includes AI, but it also includes the personal graph, which we can attach to sort of the identification of all kinds of, you know, sort of personalized data markers, whether they're around our health, whether they're around our genomics, our preferences, et cetera.
Yeah. The identity graph is the fulcrum of personalization.
Sure. And then also augmented reality, right, is another technology that's part of the smartware suite.
Yeah,
of technology.
Yeah, really mixed realities, augmented and virtual and all forms of mixed. That's
and,
right.
And of course, we can't be discussing this without, you know, also including the Internet of Things, or just the sensor dust that is going to permeate our lives sooner or later. So those are the primary smartware technologies, just to provide the listeners with a little bit of background.
Yeah, additive fabrication as well. I mean, I guess the extended list would be a longer one, but this episode isn't about smartware, right? So, John, what did Erica say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, so I think this falls into the category of something that I've known and that Erica sort of drew out in a way that was meaningful and made me pay more attention, which is this idea that we're not necessarily building artificial intelligence models to optimize for the right outcomes. So I think there's a certain flavor of the month, sort of buzzwordy importance to artificial intelligence, which sometimes can be good because it can attract funding and it can attract bright people to a technology. At the same time, it can also be technology for its own sake. And so I thought her framing of, you know, we really do need to, you know, optimize for the outcomes that we want to pursue, rather than, you know, just sort of tweaking the things that we already have, that hit home for me.
Yeah, for me, it was the example in the brain-computer interface that she shared. And like I mentioned, the concept of brain-computer interface for me goes back a long time to when I was first reading about patents. I think there were IBM patents at the time. But hearing about an application that's really working, that's you know, not a widely commercialized application, but something that is doing sort of the whole round trip of applying BCI, I thought was interesting. I was excited to see it and intrigued by what the future of that technology might look like.
Yeah, personally, I'm frightened enough by the sort of the surveillance state that we already have, let alone having a computer interface that somehow connects with my mind. Seems a little too intimate for me right now.
So what did you learn from Erica that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Yeah, this is a from a quote from Erica. She talked about distinguishing between the new and the innovative, and being able to sort of develop that sense and how important that could be. For me, I think because I spend so much time reading about new technologies, I'm often not critical enough in terms of assessing whether something is actually innovative and useful, or whether it's just a repackaging or just something that's new for the sake of newness.
And marketing, John.
I think that's, you know, part of the some of the difficulties that our tech development system, you know, has, that new things get more attention, and that things that are sort of just chugging along and might be much more important don't necessarily receive that same attention. So I think I'm going to take that theme, try to discern between the new and the innovative with me through this season, and see how we can apply it.
Amen to that. You know, I love how Erica keeps pivoting in her life. So she talks about her life mission being focused on AI as a service. But if you look at her personal history, she's done a bunch of really disparate things. John, I mean, as you know, I've made a bunch of pivots in my life too, but I'm also maybe 15 years older than Erica, maybe more. The number of interesting and impressive different things she's done in a short period of time, frankly, it really inspires the inner wanderer in me. And sometimes I think that as I get older, I'll kind of find my place instead of pivoting, jumping, and just hang out there for a good long while, maybe, you know, the rest of my whiles. But how Erica has lived her life really has my juices flowing. And I suspect I'm likely to keep changing and growing and moving into new spaces. I think she's a really inspiring person.
Yeah, I think, you know, whether you prefer to pivot or not, I think that's part of the vocabulary of the future of work. So being able to transfer skills to a new subdomain or a new, entirely new domain, I think is going to be sort of critical. And I don't mean job hopping in the same industry, but really taking your skill sets and being able to apply them where they're most needed in areas that, you know, you may have never imagined you would be working. I think that's going to be part of the experience.
Each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what applications can you imagine that would be particularly wonderful in a world with practical brain-computer interfaces? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it, @GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co. That's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most: healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at BIF.is. That's BIF.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach @DNiemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is @JohnFollett. If you want to get in touch with Erica Lee, you can connect on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram @ErikaLeeAI. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the #CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 2, Episode 1. But here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
as we diversify, the builders, the designers, the coders of these technologies, we will see greater diversity in the potential audiences and users that they can serve.